Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand and Devon in England, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. To season 2, episode 23 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, reporting live to you from a little town called Paignton in Devon, in England. It's also the middle of the night here. And in the Cinematica studio in the daytime are...
Go for it, Kaylee.
It's Kaylee.
And me, Sai.
Hey, team.
How's, is it nice and... What's the weather like over there? Has it been cold?
Dark at the moment now, I can't tell. It's 4:15 in the morning.
It's not going to be very warm.
You're a champion, Dan Slevin.
It is what the Americans call the fall, the weather has turned a little bit chilly, but it's not. It's nowhere near the New Zealand winter that I left, so I still feel like I'm gaining.
Right, but not as warm as the New York and co would have been for you.
Humid and it wasn't the height of the New York summer either, so I still didn't get the worst of that. But we're definitely good. There's a little edge to the weather. Whenever I go out, I have to think, oh, shall I take a jacket? In today's episode, we interview the extremely talented Sarkis brothers, the creators of the black New Zealand comedy Two Little Boys. We also review the new releases Ruby Sparks, Resident Evil Retribution, Joe Nesbo's Jackpot, and we go back to Costa Botes' The Last Dogs of Winter for a quick update now that that's in New Zealand cinemas. But first, let's have a look at what's in the mailbag. Kaylee, you've been monitoring all of our feedback.
Yes, so Rudy Six gave us a little tweet after last week's show saying, it was so nice to listen to you guys again, Cinematica cast. My favorite Pixar movie is Finding Nemo. Don't tell Cars. TinRibs27, his two-word review for Resident Evil Retribution, or sorry, one hyphenated word review is Jovovicious, or his full review is also on Twitter, and we retweeted that, so if you scroll through our Twitter roll, you'll be able to find that. And I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Nijmo? I'm going to go with that. 6 months ago in podcasts, I'm behind and obey chronology. Sakura 59 guests on Cinematica Cast and Lewis Bostock is mentioned. So welcome, Nijmo, or whatever your Twitter handle, however that's pronounced. Welcome to the Cinematica family.
Yeah, you are a little bit behind as well. So yes. Catch up quickly.
Yes, and Lewis Bostock would like us to do a P.T. Anderson retrospective after I kind of made a joke about doing one. So maybe we should do one for Cinematica. It wouldn't be a very long retrospective, but it would be interesting as maybe a lead up to the master.
Yeah, I think we could do it. We could afford to do a an extra, you know, to celebrate all of that. So, you know, I might mean there's a few films I have to catch up on, but still worth doing.
Yeah, I think definitely one of the things I'll pick up when I go home to Canada over Christmas is my There Will Be Blood DVD. I love that movie.
You guys are at the coalface of what's going on in New Zealand cinema at the moment. What's been happening at the top five?
A lot of new entries this week. So sitting at number five is Savages, which we are not reviewing this week because none of us got to see it and the reviews for it are so terrible that we suggest just going and finding a review and or seeing it and letting us know what you think of it.
It opens here in the UK on Friday, so I'll get to see it sometime over the weekend and maybe I'll be able to report back next week with my impressions of it, just in case.
Yeah, well, I read an interesting review today saying how when Oliver Stone wrote it, he was addicted to cocaine and that's the story of him writing it is actually more interesting than the film itself. So brace that's yourself,
true of,
Dan.
That's true of a lot of Oliver Stone's films.
Sitting at number four, down from two, is Hope Springs. Still hanging in there after 4 weeks. Good old Maryland, or Meryl Streep. Sorry.
Meryl.
Oh, God.
Go Maryland.
Yeah, go Maryland. Yeah. Woo! Down from 1 to number 3 is The Expendables 2. Premiering at number 2 is The Watch. And sitting up at number 1, the lovely Mila Jovovich, Resident Evil Retribution.
Straight in there.
Wow. Yeah.
Did you get some good writing done?
Alan, are you mad at me?
Remember how Dad used to say I had an overactive imagination?
That's good.
Kelvin, but there's no possible way that Ruby's in your house because she's not a real person.
Can you see her?
Kelvin!
She's real.
Ruby!
What is going on with you?
I don't know. I'm sorry.
Kiss me, stupid.
There's got to be some logical explanation. People don't appear out of thin air.
She did.
And Simon, you're our correspondent for Ruby Sparks. This is a film that doesn't open here in the UK until October, so I haven't had a chance to see it. What did you make of it?
Wow, so we're ahead on a few fronts on the UK, aren't we, in terms of release dates for titles?
I think.
It's pretty cool. Hey, Ruby Sparks, you know, from the makers of Little Miss Sunshine, who, you remember Paul Dano, who played the young teenage man in Little Miss Sunshine, he's got the lead in this role, along with Zoe Kazan, and it's a very charming, funny sort of fantasy romance almost, where this writer, this young Paul Dano plays this writer who has got writer's block and is struggling to get things going, and over time he creates this character, and all of a sudden this character appears in real life, and it's a fascinating film about, you know, the romance of falling in love, but then also the control that ensues and how you want to manage or dictate terms to your partner. And it's quite an interesting film. I found it, you know, it goes through a period where it's quite quirky and funny, and then it has a bit of a dark side about three quarters of the way through the film, where he starts to manipulate the relationship for his own gain. You know, every time he goes to the typewriter and writes a new chapter, it eventuates, and so it's quite a sort of interesting film from that point of view, and very well acted. I thought Zoe Kazan was exceptional in her role, so I really enjoyed it.
And I have to say that without having seen it, I'm a little bit wary of it because I didn't like Little Miss Sunshine, and I'm not a big fan of Dano as an actor. I just have never quite bought, even in There Will Be Blood, which is an otherwise amazing film, there's something about him that just doesn't quite sit well with me. So you're saying that
I've always enjoyed him. I've always found him to be quite good. I mean, I thought he was great in Little Miss Sunshine, awesome in There Will Be Blood. I thought, you know, I find him actually quite an interesting actor to watch. And this is another kind of step up, I guess, for him, where he's kind of carrying, you know, the film on his own to a large extent, or to a certain extent, you know. So, and it's a romance, which I guess I haven't seen him sort of do before in the past. So, I found him, his character to be quite, you know, believable and real, and kind of he's a wounded person who doesn't want to sort of you know, he wants a relationship that's going to be on his terms and so on. But you know, I didn't have a problem with him. I think he's good.
Well, he's got a really big year this year because he's also in Looper, which is coming up, and there's a film that was playing in New York that he's the lead actor in called For Ellen as well. So I think that he's going to be around a lot over the next few years. He's certainly pretty popular.
He does really well, like as you said, in There Will Be Blood, and he just has this character that's kind of obsessed with controlling things and putting them in a box and just having absolute power over people, the people around him and the situations around him. And whereas in There Will Be Blood, he played a minister?
Yep.
Right.
A preacher man,
yes. Where in this one, he's this kind of writer going to therapy and imagines this girlfriend who kind of comes out of nowhere. But for me, I enjoyed it, but there's some really uncomfortable moments where he's, you know, dealing with him his obsession with control, like literally controlling her and being abusive towards her. And it's that part really wasn't ever, I don't know, kind of tied up. It was just kind of left, you're left a bit raw afterwards, feeling a bit uncomfortable and being like, well, I don't think I'd ever want to date someone like that, or remembering someone that you have dated like that who's a total psycho and that's why you left them.
But you see, it's about power. It's about having power in a relationship. And ultimately, you know, he gets corrupted by having this power and this ability to create whatever he wants, to get her to do whatever she wants. You know, there's a scene where he says, I'll make her talk French, types away, and then all of a sudden she's talking French. You know, like, and to what lengths will people go to use that power? And there's a breaking point in the film where, you know, he it's almost like he's purging that from himself, and it's not a nice scene. It's a tough scene, but it's, you know, but it's actually fascinating to watch, though. I thought she was you know, what she does,
her performance is incredible.
Yeah, she is really amazing. And so I didn't find it icky. I actually thought it was, you know, like I felt it maybe took a little bit too long to get to that point, but I didn't actually find that too sort of icky. I thought, you know, and I was kind of expecting it, you know, that there was going to be this conflict, and that you just couldn't have this artificial world continued forever, because it wasn't healthy for him and it wasn't healthy for her. And he and it's that purging at the end where he realizes that, and he goes through this process of hurting her. He does. He really emotionally, you know, he really hurts her. But not in a physical way, just mentally, you know, like he just sort of. You know, I thought, you know, like, I mean, you know, it was, you get sucked into this world and it's quite believable. And it sort of raises the question, what would, you know, with that sort of, you know, manipulation over somebody, you know, how would people behave?
Well, something interesting that might add a few layers to your appreciation of the film is that it was actually written by Zoe Kazan, which I think is interesting, and also that she and Paul Dano are a couple in real life. So one wonders whether there was she was sort of working anything out of her system in writing the film.
Well, it certainly allows them to show off quite a range. Of their acting ability. Like it really does kind of let them, you know, go through quite a huge range of acting skills, I reckon, and particularly her. I think, you know, what she has to do is a strong vehicle for her, I reckon.
Now remind me, Simon, is this opened already in New Zealand, or is it opening on Thursday?
It opens on Thursday, yeah.
So if you're listening on Thursday, it's opening today.
And it's going pretty wide?
I would expect so, even though, you know, the proof's in the pudding tomorrow when you open the paper and have a look. Right. But no, I'd expect it'll be a fairly wide release. I mean, there's a bit of, you know, there's a bit of a campaign behind this one. And they, you know, I think, you know, justifiably, I'd like to see it do well. I mean, I really enjoyed it.
Right, and certainly with Little Miss Sunshine on the board as a
how could you not like Little Miss Sunshine, Dan? Like, really?
Yeah, because my heart is made of stone, evidently. Oh, Simon, what can I say? I have a real problem with Paul Dano, and I have a real problem with Greg Kinnear, and that's the whole film.
There's these great little roles by Antonio Banderas and Annette Bening and Steve Coogan in the film. It's got a neat supporting cast there.
Oh, that's great. Annette Bening's fantastic. So that's the definite plus point. I'll be along for that.
Oh, yeah, but here she is playing another kind of hippie, you know, a wood-turning hippie or something like that. You know, like.
All right, Simon, do you have two words for us?
No, I didn't have two words for today, but I just think must see. How's that? A must-see film. Go to it.
Kay, have you got two words?
I do. I leaked my two words earlier today. It was enjoyable. But I'm going to go with hipster fluff.
Hipster fluff. Oh, this. Oh, of all the hipster fluff, you picked this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I'll also add Brooklyn hipster fluff as well, because they're apparently a kind of Brooklyn power couple. Those two. I was being told while I was in New York that they're quite prominent in the social scene there. I haven't seen it yet, so I can't add two words, even if I wanted to. And I hope that it's still playing by the time I get back. I imagine it will be. It's.
I'll put it on for you, Dan.
I think it'll have some legs.
Alice, how nice to see you again.
What the hell is going on here?
We have you under our control.
They used me to perfect the virus. Everyone I've ever known. Everything I've ever done has been used against me. Now they can manipulate the world.
We've taken over New York, Moscow, Tokyo. This is humanity's last stand. The beginning of the end.
I'm gonna kill you.
Good luck. You'll need it.
Episode 5 of Resident Evil. This one's called Retribution. Our futuristic 3D zombie correspondent is Kaylee.
Yes, thank you very much. So Resident Evil Retribution, I did go see it in 3D, and I did get to watch it in a, I will not name which cinema I went to, but it was incredibly loud, so those of you in Wellington probably know what I'm talking about. So this is the fifth installment of the sci-fi zombie horror franchise, which is adapted from the Capcom video game, and was written and directed by Paul W.S. Anderson, who brought us the gem, The Three Musketeers, which also had Mila Jovovich in it. So if you want to know what we thought of Three Musketeers, you could go back to our back catalog and find it in there.
Take a guess.
Yeah. So, of course, it's starring Mila Jovovich as Alice, who continues to find and assist survivors in a world ravaged by a virus infection that turns its victims into the undead. Now, being a bit of a zombie, I wouldn't say expert, but a zombie scholar, I had a lot of issues with this film. Because there didn't seem to be a standard for zombie behavior with the zombies that Paul W. Anderson had. They, for whatever reason, they could run upstairs, they could find things, they could pick things up, they could use weapons. The zombies in Moscow, who were undead World War II victims in full uniforms, were able to ride motorcycles and shoot guns and blow up bazookas and things like that, yet the zombies who were in the suburbs could run upstairs but couldn't figure out how to step up onto something to chase Alice into the attic. So that didn't make any sense. But anyway, I don't think anyone else noticed that, and I'm just a total nerd. I actually really enjoyed watching this film. It was fun. It was full of action. I couldn't stop laughing because it's just so ridiculous. It's like, oh, quick, get in the car. We'll escape. Oh, no, but 2 seconds later, we're going to be hit by a semi. Oh, the zombies are still coming. So everyone else was screaming and scared, and I was, like, crying because I was laughing so hard. And it's for, you know what, for a genre film, it's great. Like, the effects and the way the set was done was very futuristic, pretty exciting. Casting wasn't so great. I was going to look it up. There's some Canadian actors I recognize in there. So, you know, it's a film based off of a video game, so you're not going to get great performances. But that being said, it felt a lot like a video game. It felt like I was watching the extended film that usually comes within these sort of sci-fi horror big games like this. So it really, it did itself quite a few favors, although now it would be kind of boring to play the video game because I've already sat through it. So
my memory of the last one is that there are two or three really big sort of set pieces that are designed to make you go, wow, what an amazing imagination, or what a, you know, the way that it finds new locations for its sort of post-apocalyptic sort of scenario, and you go, oh wow, that's actually Las Vegas, or oh wow, that's actually whatever. Is it still got that same sort of inventiveness?
It's pretty good. The way it's set up is she's trapped inside the Umbrella Corporation, and they have these different testing grounds basically where they check out how an actual biohazard would go. So they have a Moscow set, they have a suburbia set, they have a Japan set, and they have one other. So the character is to meet up and to escape, because this is all like underwater, to meet up and escape, they have to go through all these different locations and deal with all these animals that are coming. So actually it reminded me quite a bit of Cabin in the Woods, but not as funny and not as good, but still had that range of all these like crazy characters that just come out of nowhere and you have to defeat them in every level. So that made it very video game-like, is the characters in the film having to go through these different levels. So yeah.
And my other memory of not just of the last Resident Evil film, but also Three Musketeers, was for all of the faults of those two films, P.W.S. Anderson has quite a good idea about how to use 3D. Like, I really thought the 3D in Three Musketeers was good. And of all the modern directors using 3D for action movies, the last Resident Evil was the best of them, I thought.
Yeah, the 3D was quite impressive. It used really well. There's a few, you get blood splattered on you, and there's a few like knives being thrown at you, but it looked really good. Like, what he's lacking in a script, he's definitely made up in visuals, and uses the 3D really well. And there's using depth and having people and objects stand out was quite nice.
Cool. Have you got two words for us?
My two words is genre geeking.
Good stuff. All right, time for some news.
So, the Toronto Film Festival announced their awards on Sunday with David O. Russell's The Silver Linings Playbook taking out the coveted People's Choice Awards, although there were mutterings from the media that they were the best at taking advantage of the new online voting system.
Apparently nobody understood how it was supposed to work, except for the distributors or the studio behind that film.
Sounds like Florida.
The Critics' Prize was taken out by Mikhail Marsimain's debut feature from Sweden, Call Girl, and the Midnight Madness Prize went to Martin McDonagh's long-awaited follow-up to In Bruges, Seven Psychopaths, which stars Colin Farrell, Sam Rockwell, Woody Harrelson, and Christopher Walken.
Looking forward to that. Is that shown up on anybody's distribution list for New Zealand yet, Simon? Do you know?
Yeah, it has. And Don't quote me, but I think it's due out before Christmas. But
good.
Yeah, I think they're going to try and slot it in there. They've got big reps on it.
Excellent.
I loved In Bruges, so if it's anywhere, you know, like that, then it'll play well and last, which would be great.
The other Paul Anderson, P.T. Anderson, has broken the per-screen record for a specialized platform release, i.e. Arthouse, with The Master's first weekend haul of $730,000.
At how many screens, Kaylee?
Five.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be great?
That's what I'm talking about.
That's it. That's it. That's what you call a platform release.
Yes.
Whoa, take note, rest of the world.
There's been no change to the New Zealand release date for the film, which is basically, we don't know. Roadshow are still working on a strategy for the film, they say, which might mean straight to video after some World Cinema Showcase screenings in April, which would be an absolute crime. We need a cinema release for this film. People need to go see it.
Yes. No, that would be a bit of an outrage if that happened.
There are some saddos on Twitter who are basically losing their cool over The Master, aren't there?
Mm.
I don't know.
They can't wait.
I think it's getting such strong momentum. How could you not give it a good strong release around Oscar time? You'd have to.
And the only thing on Twitter this week is The Master in Dread 3D. So as very exciting. Continuing on, that strategy might change now that the Academy has announced changes to key dates for next year's Oscars. Wah, wah. Also, the actual ballots won't go out until the 8th of February, giving Academy members just 11 days to actually vote. That is bananas. 11 days.
No, I think that's really good. I think that's really good because it means that they won't just vote for the last thing they've seen. They've actually got to watch a whole lot more stuff before they decide.
Sweet.
Yeah, and it's fantastic news for New Zealand because it means that instead of compressing all of the Oscar candidates into a four-week period, they can spread the releases out a little bit.
Another 2 weeks to play with.
Yeah. Makes a big difference.
Oh, it does. No, you're right. It'll be nice to have if they get their release strategy kind of in play with that.
All right. Now to our special feature on the show today. Before I left New Zealand, I was lucky enough to have a decent amount of time with Robert and Duncan Sarkis, who are the creative forces, the writer, director of Two Little Boys, the new New Zealand film, which has been making a lot of noise around the country. They had a big star-studded premiere down in Invercargill last week, and the film is in cinemas from Thursday. Am I right? Correct me if I'm wrong, team.
You're right.
So today, if you're listening Thursday.
Recently changed from an R16 to an R15 as well.
Yes.
Not very often that happens.
No,
that is interesting. That R15 is a very rarely used rating, and I think there's maybe some distributor pressure there to try and open it up just a little bit to, I think, a core audience for the film, which will be the sort of the teenage boy market. There's a lot of humour in the film that I think would really appeal to them. The interview that I did with the boys was around about 45 minutes long, so that's going to be made available in a little while as an extra episode of Cinematica, so the whole thing, which covers their careers to date and gives you a really good background to the guys. We've just taken 10 minutes out of it for the show today, so it's a little bit of a taster of the full interview. And I started off by asking the guys a little bit about the reason to set the film down in Invercargill.
I want to talk about the location now and the Southland-ness of it. And was it always intended that would be where these characters would inhabit, or was it characters first and then let's find somewhere for them to live?
Well, it was characters first. And they lived originally in Dunedin, but they were always in the book and in the early prose writing that when we were initially developing a film idea, they always were going to go on a road trip to the Catlins from Dunedin.
But the characters were always very, like, it was written in Dunedin or something because we know Dunedin, and so that therefore it comes flooding out of you. And Dunedin versus Invercargill, I mean, the fact there is just that Invercargill actually has a lot of similarities with Dunedin. You know, our sister school when we were at Cocker Valley High School was James Hargest. And always sort of had a feeling that Invercargill, that it was quite a similar life down in Invercargill to what we were experiencing in Dunedin. I never really thought that it would be that different, if anything, even more accentuated.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in a way this relates to the characters themselves. You know, the characters, as you've observed, they're quite extreme personalities, you know, and that really suits comedy because it gives you kind of a comic, well, I mean, you know, a lot of comic characters are pretty extreme, you know, maybe they're, you know, and so those extreme personalities who also, for the story to work, need to have a certain naivety to them. I mean, it's called Two Little Boys because it's essentially two little kids in growing, you know, mid-20-year-old bodies. it's that sort of world of those characters needed to sit in a world that feels somewhat naive, right? Somewhat more simple,
unworldly,
somewhat unworldly, and so really that could be any small town, pretty much anywhere in the world, but it couldn't be a city, right? It couldn't be a big city. In fact, I'd argue... It
couldn't be a liberal city.
No, in fact, in a way, it could be Dunedin back when we were growing up in Dunedin, which Dunedin was quite a depressed place now. I mean, Dunedin was quite a depressed place then in the 80s, you know, basically last one out closed the door, you know, certainly in a business sense. Well, that's completely... The whole place is completely transformed, really. It's quite a hip place now. It's got its own, you know, fashion awards and film scene. So I think that just the world of the film needed to fit these characters. If you have a disconnect there, then you'd be in trouble and people wouldn't buy it. Now, it's one of the other reasons that we chose to set the film back in the 90s, you know, and it wasn't just because, you know, it's a lot of fun with costuming and we could relate to it with our childhood and stuff. It's also, you know, it's like kids are hipper now, you know, they wouldn't make some of the choices that these guys make. And so, you know, you just try and find I guess in any storytelling, you're just trying to find the right path through that seems to make sense of it seems to make sense for the world of these characters. I mean, we had a really odd moment when we once, long time ago, actually pitched the story to a TV network. Because we thought, oh, maybe actually their lives together could make a really great TV series. It probably could, actually.
It's the prequel to the
film. This has been, it's been a long journey. But, and the network executive, you know, was quite interested in our pitch, you know, and definitely responding to it on a level. But the first question she asked was, could you set this in Auckland? And our hearts just sunk. We just knew, no, you could not set this in Auckland. We could set it almost anywhere else other than Auckland or Wellington or Christchurch,
yeah,
probably.
Auckland, you know? Oh, no, Christchurch would be all right.
Maybe, yeah.
Auckland,
yeah.
And Wellington.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. But there's something about Invercargill being the last stop before Antarctica, really. It's like there's an extremity. Yeah. About Invercargill that means that it's sort of there. The character's otherworldliness is reflected in the kind of otherworldliness of the place as well.
Yeah, and we forget that, I think, in New Zealand. I mean, New Zealand itself is the last, from an international perspective, is the last stop before Antarctica. So we've sort of gone to the last stop of the last stop, and I think that gives us some permission to. Kind of to push things a bit, you know, these two characters very much exist in their own incredibly isolated world. They've been in a relationship or a friendship for 15 years, and the problem has been that's been their lives, right? And really the story is about the Brett McKenzie character trying to break out of that life and find another life, a more satisfying, a richer life, a life that will actually lead somewhere, whereas the Hamish Blake character just wants it always to be the same.
Yeah, well, let's keep it the same. And that does really represent that sort of moment when we're often all at a crossroads and some people stay and some people go.
Yeah. The catalyst for the story in the film is a tragedy, and yet it's an extremely amusing moment in the film, and that opening scene where Brett's character is trying to deal with the after effects of the stupidity that he's perpetrated, it sets the tone straight away for the sort of black comedy that we're going to experience through the film as a whole. How have audiences responded to that? Do they buy it straight away with the direction you're going to take with the film, or are people sort of horrified?
I think they buy it because we work pretty hard to make the opening pretty silly, I think with anything Duncan and I do, we're never trying to do just one genre, and you know, we could equally be criticized for that, but we could also equally be celebrated for it. I mean, actually, I think it's a great thing for filmmakers to be trying to bounce around between genres and to, you know, not fit within, you know, a box. I mean, yes, I guess Two Little Boys is a black comedy, but we never think that way when we're setting out to write something. We just go, is there a story here? What's happening on these characters? Can we find some depth within it? And is it naturally funny?
I'd like to think that that opening is a little bit like the Darwin Awards. In that sense, and you often do read about crimes as well on page 5 of a newspaper or somewhere deep in a newspaper, and it's the comedy item of the news where you couldn't believe that someone did something so ridiculous and made so many bad decisions. But I just think the Darwin Awards, but with survivors, and it's great.
Yeah, there was a story in the latter point of when we were writing this, that ridiculous story of. Is it Tony Stadlick? The hand that was found, the severed hand that was found out at Red Rocks in Wellington. Yeah. You read that story, and basically these two guys, who I presume are now in prison. They cut off the hands of their drug dealer or their drug dealer friend before dumping his body in the sea, because they in 2000 and whatever it was, 7 probably or around then, they naively assumed that that way no one would be able to identify him. You know, so when people kind of
do they not look, watch when, CSI?
Well, exactly. When people look at something like, say, Two Little Boys and goes, oh, these characters are really stupid. Well, actually, look around, read page 5, you know, go out, go to a pub somewhere that's not in central Auckland or central Wellington, and you will find people who think different to you.
Mm. There's logic involved.
Yeah.
But it's just that the logic might be a bit misguided.
It's a bit naive.
And it has that wonderful momentum about it in terms of bad decision being piled upon bad decision to the extent where it's not very far into it before you can't unwind it.
Yeah, and that's the Dino character is a wonderful character for all of it, simply because he's a guy that's real act now, think later. And he thinks, because whereas you've got a character in Nige who any situation he'll freak out and he'll be thrown into some kind of paralysis, so he needs that friend, and he thinks initially that friend is making good decisions on his behalf, but actually that friend is... He's the guy that wanted to be in World War One and jumping from trench to trench, and he might have got lucky, but it's all adrenaline.
Action, yeah.
He's an action hero on some levels, and yes, he's thinking on his feet, and he is thinking, but sometimes it could have been wise for him to just take a little bit more time with his plans.
That's Robert and Duncan Sarkis talking to me a little earlier on this year about Two Little Boys, and the full 45-minute version of that is a Cinematica extra that will be downloadable from iTunes or from the website very soon. You can listen to the whole thing. All three of the team have seen Two Little Boys, so I thought we'd take a little bit of a little moment to discuss it. Simon, you first. I know you're pretty enthusiastic about the film.
Yeah, I for some reason I went into this film thinking it would be a lot, you know, it'd be quite a dark film, and so I guess maybe I just had this, you know, this idea beforehand that sort of helped me, you know, actually see it. It came across as a lot lighter. I found that it was just neat to see these guys on screen. It was neat to see, you know, a part of New Zealand filmed this way. It's just really. I just love it when you see films that you know, generally it works, and it's set in a part of New Zealand which, you know, how often does it get any sort of screen time? And they all do, you know, and it has a lot of sort of laugh out loud funny moments in it. For me it was quite refreshing, to be honest, and nice to see not, you know, a New Zealand film that's not a documentary that's this sort of fun sort of black comedy, and so I actually think, you know, it'll appeal to, you know, a reasonably wide audience. I think in Wellington particularly with you know, with Brett McKenzie in there, there'll be some, you know, quite strong support. So I'm hoping that it actually plays a bit older and wider than just the teen market, because I think it's got more for it. Going for it than that.
It's the blackest of black comedies, isn't it? Has there ever been a New Zealand film that goes to so many dark places as this one does? Kaylee, what did you think?
I enjoyed it. And speaking of films that go to dark places, all I can think of is early Peter Jackson stuff. But, you know, it's for me, this is like the New Zealand's answer to FUBAR, which I know, Dan, you've seen both volumes of. It's just this over the top crazy bromance where it's kind of all or nothing, and yeah, I enjoyed it. I mean, it's definitely cringeworthy in some parts. I mean, they have to hack up a body
and put it in a backpack.
Yeah.
But Brett's character doesn't do that. It's Hamish, isn't it? And he's the guy. I take a bullet for you, man. Like this obsessive mate who I reckon we've all probably had a friend like that. This. Oh, come on, man. I'd do it for you. Come on. You know, I'd take a bullet for you, mate. You know what I mean? Like, just that.
He's the friend who your mum says, if he jumped off the cliff, would you jump off the cliff?
Yes. He's that man, isn't he?
Yes. So, yeah, I thought it was really, really fun. one of the better, you know, New Zealand feature films I've seen since moving here. So I really enjoyed it. So yeah, I recommend it. If you're a squeamish person, just beware. Maybe get Jaffas instead of gummies or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a long way. Politically correct, which I think is really refreshing as well. Yeah. I think that it says it shows a lot more of, I think, Duncan's warped sense of humour than perhaps Roberts. I think it's probably more of a Duncan story than it is than Roberts. And I really enjoyed it as well. And one of the key reasons I enjoyed it was the casting of Hamish Blake. I know that we often give film companies and filmmakers in New Zealand a bit of a hard time for casting in Australia when there are so many brilliant New Zealand actors. And so often you think, oh, they're just trying to get somebody from Australia to so that it'll sell to the Australian market, and it's easy to be cynical about that, but Hamish Blake I thought was just terrifically funny all the way through. And you know, for a basically a two-hander like this, you know, you need a comic foil and a straight man, and I think that relationship is just plays out really, really well all the way through. But Hamish Blake, very, very funny guy, and I sort of forgive them for finding an Australian to do it.
Yeah, no, he's really... it's funny seeing him as the dominant kind of comic role, and Brett McKenzie's actually kind of more, you know, the quieter of the two, the more reserved. It's, you know, he's trying to break free of this overpowering relationship that Hamish's character has with him.
That's the theme of this week's show: overpowering relationships. We have Ruby Sparks, true. We have two little boys, we have Resident Evil.
Yep, it's but oh, geez. But you know, because when was this written, Dan? This was written a wee while ago, wasn't it? I was just trying to think. You know, it's quite a When it was written, you know, I mean, there was a bit of dark history here in New Zealand with missing tourists and that sort of thing, and it seems to tap into that quite risque from that point of view, given that it might have been written not long after those sorts of things happening.
Despite the beautiful Catlins locations, I suspect that the New Zealand Tourist Board is not going to approve this film.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, because the whole premise, you know, this getting rid of this Scandinavian tourist and then looking, you know, I mean, knocking off more people as they go and so on. And look, but you know, for me, now that I think about the film, the thing that stands out for me most, and to me it's like such a distinctly New Zealand thing to do, that the sense of humor, the way it's filmed, everything, is the dolphin scene. I mean, it's just a brilliant scene, you know. You see, look what it does to Kaylee.
It's in the trailer.
Yeah, I can't, you know, I don't want to spoil it for everyone, but it's just such a funny, to me, it's just such this perfect New Zealand kind of scene that you just wouldn't see anywhere else in the world.
Mm. All right, I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you have two words for me?
My two words would be grim, and I'm going to compress New Zealand into Nuzzaland.
Nuzzaland.
Grim Nuzzaland.
From New Zealand.
Oh, yeah, okay, so if you're going to cheat a little bit, I'm going to cheat a little bit, and mine carry on Catlins.
My one is obsessive mate.
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 There they are, don't die.
Sitter du her som mistenkt? Eller sitter du her som vittne?
En liten detalj du har glemt. Hva var det dreid seg om der oppe? Var det narko?
Nei, det var tipping.
Og tipping?
All right, that's a little bit of Norwegian for you. For your new Norwegian scholars, you'll know what that's all about. Joe Nesbø's Jackpot. That's a new film from Norway, which is written by the same guy who produced the novel Headhunters, which was turned into a very successful film earlier on this year. I don't think the creative team behind the film are the same as the Headhunters team, but certainly the what is it with Scandinavia and crime? They seem to be churning them out, don't they, at the moment. This is a film that I think has already opened, am I right?
It's been going about a week, yeah.
About a week?
Yeah.
Have either of you two managed to catch it?
Afraid not. No, I haven't.
All right, well, I'll just give you a quick rundown about it. A guy gets a job at a Christmas tree, a plastic Christmas tree factory, and there's a bunch of sort of hooligans and layabouts that work in that factory, and he's pressed into joining their football pool, what would you call them?
Collective.
Yeah, there's a group of them that that bet on the Norwegian football every week. He joins in, and one week he changes one of the bets because he just thinks he knows better. But that change actually gets them the win. They win the football pool and there are now. Five of them, I think, that had to split the money. They send him off into town to go and get some booze so they can celebrate. And when he comes back, there's only four of them. One of them's already been done over. And it turns out that these guys, they're not really into sharing. And so a tussle begins for sort of supremacy over who's going to actually end up going to the bank to cash this winning ticket. It's all told in flashback, which is it sets the whole story up really, really well in like the first few seconds, and it's pacey, it's humorous, and you know, we were talking a little bit about themes for the show. Well, one of the themes for the show could be disposing of bodies, because there's quite a lot of inventive body disposal going on in Jackpot as well. It's only about 90 minutes long, which is a blessing these days. It's kind of tight. It's very, again, very dark humor, very violent, lots and lots of blood and weapons and subtitled swearing. The director's obviously watched a lot of early Quentin Tarantino, I would say, without necessarily, you know, it doesn't quite reach those giddy heights, and it also doesn't reach the giddy heights of Joe Nesbo's earlier film, The Headhunters, which I think we all liked, didn't we, team?
Yeah, does Jackpot have that same black humor to it, or is it a bit more straightforward?
Definitely got a lot of black humor about it, because it's very morbid humor. So yeah, I would say that it's a black comedy in a similar vein to Two Little Boys, but darker and more adult. Like, I don't think Jackpot will be getting an R15 anytime soon.
Getting a downscaling of their
I don't think anyone's going to be bothering to appeal that one down. But you know, if you liked Headhunters, I think, you know, Jackpot would hit the same buttons for you. Although I have to say, it's not as good.
Is the lead as sympathetic as you had in Headhunters? Because that was the whole beauty of Headhunters, wasn't it? Was that this guy was a bit of an ass, but he turned out to be, as the film progressed, you felt sorry for him and kind of warmed to him as it went.
Yeah, it follows the same arc, but not as successfully, I would say. So similar sort of theme, but not not quite as successful. And the twists aren't as big and aren't as, so it's not as satisfying a narrative as Headhunters. And to be honest, all of the characters, but you know, all of the thugs and hoons who decide to take each other out after winning this football pool, they're all pretty objectionable bunch of people. So you're not sorry when they go. So it's hard to know. It's hard to have anyone really to root for, to be honest.
All right. Well, two words for it?
My two words are Reservoir Norwegians.
Nice.
And we'll just jump straight into our last film of the show, and that is, I know we mentioned it in our festival preview, didn't we? The Last Dogs of Winter, Costa Botas, is a very successful film that if New Zealand had an audience prize for its festival, it may well have taken that one out. It's back in cinemas now. Hayley, do you want to tell us a little bit about, I mean, you're our snow expert.
Canadian husky expert, yes.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with a husky Canadian expert, that's different. So yes, it's the latest documentary by Costa about Brian Ledoux, who is kind of a infamous character up in the northern part of Winnipeg, who has dedicated his life to saving the almost extinct Canadian Eskimo, attracting controversy along the way due to his methods. Yeah, so, I mean, I wanted to go to it immediately. It's a Canadian story, but also there's some New Zealand flavor in there, not just because it's by Costa, but also there is a young New Zealander who is actually working as Brian's first-hand man, who's been working up there for several years now, working with these huskies and keeping them alive because, of course, the indigenous populations of in the northern parts of Canada no longer need sled dogs. So these sled dogs were kind of fell under the axe, so to say, not so nicely, of the Canadian government to try to get rid of them to introduce snowmobiles and get the locals using, you know, fuels and getting around quicker. So Brian has dedicated his life with a very small team of people and very little money to saving them. So it's a really interesting look at someone who is committed, obsessed, you could say, about maintaining a very important part of Canada's heritage, which is quite interesting and quite moving.
And it all self-funded, eh? Like, there was no government support there whatsoever. It was, and it was funny, wasn't it? Because I didn't realize that this place became such a mecca for the polar bears. So everyone trucks up there and gets photographs of the polar bears, and they've got all these dogs around the mix as well, where they kind of interact with each other, these polar bears. And some of the more touching parts of the film are, you know, when you see these polar bears and these dogs all sort of like, you know, nuzzling each other and stuff like that. But he was very obsessive, though, wasn't he? He was kind of like so passionate and driven that everything else kind of got pushed aside. I thought, like, he was an interesting character. And it was good to have that balance of the New Zealand chaps, you know, because he was kind of more down to earth and I don't know, he just seemed a good foil to him. But yeah, interesting film. I enjoyed it.
Yes, and the young man in question is Caleb Ross, who was actually when he was younger, he was a TV star here in New Zealand. So
he was on Shortland Street, I think.
Yes, I know a couple of people who went to the film festival screening simply because they used to have a teen crush on Caleb. So that's great. He's still very good looking.
Just remind me, this is a film that's that is slowly working its way around the country. Is it still screening in Auckland?
Yeah, it is. It's still in Auckland, and it opens in Wellington tomorrow. So it's a fairly tight release that it's getting, but probably right for the size of film that it is. And I think, you know, Costa's done an extremely good job with this film. I think it's a very interesting look at something that you wouldn't necessarily come across. So I'd recommend it. I don't know if I'd put it, you know, in the same, I don't know, like for me, How Far Is Heaven is probably, you know, of those two films that played in the festival, I think I'd probably lean towards How Far Is Heaven. It's quite an interesting film as well, but very different docos, I guess. I'd recommend it.
All right. So two words.
Woof, woof.
and my two words are puppy love.
All right, and my two for The Last Dogs of Winter, Costa Botta's film, are Chili Hounds.
Oh.
All right, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Next week, I'll still be in England for my final podcast on this tour. We'll also be reviewing Two Little Boys. Oh, no, we've just done Two Little Boys. Scratch that. Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted, and, of course, another possibly long-awaited Kiwi movie. They had a big premiere this week as well, Kiwi Flyer. That's due out in time for... Is it school holidays coming up, Simon?
It is, in another week, I think, another week or so. And can I just say, Madagascar 3 is like, it's like the other ones were on, were just in slow motion. It's on speed, Madagascar 3. It is just a hell of a roller coaster ride, but I won't say it much more than that.
Well, it's enormously frustrating to me because it had been and gone from the United States while I was there. It opened in something like June in America and had disappeared from cinemas. It doesn't open here in the UK until October, mid-October, which is half-term holidays for the kids here. So it's not in any cinemas here. And so I've just – everywhere I've gone, it's either – I can't see it. And, of course, you guys are going to get to – you've already seen it, Simon, but yep. Kayleigh, you're going to get – this is one of I don't think I'm going to be destroying my critic credentials too much by saying this is one of my most awaited films of the year, Madagascar 3. I just love the franchise. Now, I was going to ask you guys a little bit of a favour, and maybe listeners too, because of this weird international release strategy thing. There's a whole lot of films that I can't watch that are going to be on in New Zealand, and I can't watch them because they don't open here until mid-October or even later. But there are a few films playing here in the UK that won't open in New Zealand until later. So, like, for example, Anna Karenina, which is already in cinemas here. The Sweeney doesn't open in New Zealand until January, and that's already playing here. To Rome with Love, the new Woody Allen film. Samsara, the follow-up to Baraka, which I'm really looking forward to seeing. And a film called Cockneys vs. Zombies, which I suspect...
Go see it!
I suspect it won't actually make it to New Zealand cinemas anytime soon. So of those that I've already seen Dread. I saw Dread last night, and we can talk about that in a couple of weeks' time because that does open in New Zealand reasonably soon. And I saw Paranorman on Sunday, which doesn't open in New Zealand until the summer holidays. So I'm banking a few, but if there's anything in that list, Lawless is another one, that the new John Hillcoat film with Shia LaBeouf, that one's playing in cinemas around the country here. So any requests for films that people think I should go and see so we can talk about them next week, I'm happy to indulge them. Otherwise, I'll see you all again here same god awful time of the morning.
You're a trooper.
Yes.
Yeah. Well done, Dan.
And if people want to send you those requests, they can. Should they tweet you directly or tweet us at CinematicaCast?
Definitely. Because I'm going to be sort of going in and out of coverage areas while I'm around here. So you can continue to monitor our social media feeds. Where else can they get in touch with us?
They can find us, you all listening right now, go to Facebook and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast. And also, as always, on our website at www.cinematica.co.nz.
And if you don't want us to be pestering you on social media to remind you to download the show, you can subscribe in iTunes or whatever your favorite podcasting software is, so that every Thursday morning you wake up and there it is, ready for you to go out jogging or whatever it is, however it is you listen to the show. This show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music. This is from the soundtrack of Savages, which I thought we were going to be reviewing this week, but we might get to next week. It's by somebody called Yuna, who I've never heard of, and it's a lovely little cover version of the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun. Until next week, it's good night from me.
Good night from me.
And good night from me.